Let's change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, this is Mickey Desai, your host for the Nonprofit Snapcast. Very happy to be talking today with Lisa Greer, who's an author, donor, board member, and philanthropic strategist, advisor to nonprofits and to philanthropies alike. Is that fair to say, Lisa?
Yes.
And I want to talk about a number of things. I mean, your blog is Philanthropy 451, and you and I were going to basically riff off of your blog for a minute, but you sent me a copy of your book, Philanthropy Revolution, rather. And there's the title of your first chapter just really grabs me. And before we get into the title of the first chapter, I've got to say I found the book really easy to read and very informative, and I hope that nonprofits and nonprofit leaders out there get an opportunity to pick it up and give it a gander. But the title of the first chapter is Philanthropy is in Trouble. Can we break that down for a minute?
Sure. So the motivation behind the book was a lot of different things happened to us when I first became a philanthropist. We had a liquidation event at my husband's company, and I sold my company and about the same time. And we became philanthropists, but we had been regular working people, albeit managers, whatever, in the entertainment industry and other industries for many, many years. And when we tried to donate money, not having been what I call it on the list, the regular people people who've been lifelong donors, and we tried to make some substantial donations, we were ignored. And we were just told, we weren't even told anything, actually. They just basically didn't believe us. And
You tried to make donations and people would not believe you.
Yeah, they wouldn't take our money. So I know that sounds insane, but it's true. And if you've read the book, so you've seen that and read about it and other people were happy to share a story. We just decided to I decided and then dragged along my husband, but we decided that that this was shocking and we needed to figure out a way to fix it. That this we came from business, we came from being sort of paycheck to paycheck kind of people, and all of a sudden we had a lot of money. And we immediately thought, well, of course, we're going to donate it. It wasn't a question the question was where. We picked the organizations we wanted to contribute to initially, and then we called them, or in one case, I just emailed somebody from nowhere and just said, here, I'm just very impressed with what you're doing. I saw your website. Here's a check. And everybody was dumbfounded. They didn't know what to do. And it was insane, I know. And so it wasn't a one-time thing. It was because they looked us up and they didn't know who we were. We weren't on their list. We weren't the previous donors. They hadn't done their screens on us. And they didn't see a donor history of ours with big dollars. And so they thought they must have thought that we were kidding or we were something. And all they had to do was look at stock market records and they would have seen the amount of stock that we had sold and that we had in the company that had been valued at one point $1 billion. But they just couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle that we hadn't gone through the steps and they hadn't made the ask and screened us and cultivated and all of that stuff. We were just wanting to give them money. And they just, it just blew their minds. And it blew our minds that that was a thing. It was just very strange. It was, and I also thought when we became wealthy and had this liquidation event, it wasn't like it was hidden. It was because the investment community, meaning the stock brokerage houses, they all found us. They all called like crazy. Mm-hmm. But it took a good year and a half, believe it or not, from that time of the liquidation event to when people started calling us and had us recognized as being quote on the list. So that's a really, really long time. And yet the stock brokerage people were calling within days. So I just, that was really, fascinating to us that what's going on. I mean, so the immediate thought was what's going on with this world of fundraising? Like, why is this happening? And so I decided that I wanted to find out if this was just my experience and I was just had bad luck and had the experience with three or four organizations really in the first month. And then I found out that, no, this is actually something that is a systemic problem for nonprofits. But in fact, what I was told by one academic was that everybody knows that this is a problem and that the way it's done is arcane and doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and that somebody needs to talk about it, but that nobody wants to talk about it because it's easier to just, you know, do the same thing over and over again, which of course is also the, you know, concept of insanity. So
right, right.
I think it's really strange. And so we started, you know, I asked a lot of donors, I asked friends, and I just found out that almost everybody had had some sort of experience like this, or some sort of a negative experience with fundraisers that made them not want to give to that organization. And in some cases made them not want to give at all. And then I did some research and noticed that, well, gosh, back then it was about 100 billion. Now there's $122 billion of money sitting in donor advised funds. And I thought, well, why is that money sitting there? Are those just people who don't want to give and just want a tax benefit, which some people think is true? My conclusion is, are there a lot of people who just don't want to play this game with fundraisers where you try and give them money and they don't want to take it, or they ask you for money without doing research, or they you know, send you emails to the wrong person's name or in 5 different colors or any of those things? And so they just say, you know, forget it, I'm not gonna play the game, I'm not gonna jump in. If they have one bad experience, I think they lock up the money or they give it to their cat.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm hearing several things in reaction to what you're saying. I mean, I've even tried to do a memorial gift for my father when he died, and the organization that was the recipient of that memorial gift kept sending my father mail even after the fact.
Oh,
and
ouch.
And I'm like, wait, you do realize what a memorial gift is, right? And on the one hand, you know, we think that stewardship should be pretty simple and it's very straightforward. It's about, you know, at least in my mind, stewardship is about genuine relationships and good communication. On the other hand, it does seem like the nonprofit sector needs continual help becoming better stewards. Would you agree, or am I wrong with that?
So,
or?
The experience with your father is horrifying. I think everybody would agree. What I find is 2 parts. One is, from a practical basis, organizations for some reason don't want to parse their lists, even though that is not a novel concept and has been doable online, you know, on computers for, I don't know, maybe 3 decades. And so they just don't want to do it. I don't know why. They just think it's too much work or it's too hard. And so, you know, in the case of your father, obviously they should have had a parsed piece of the list, which were memorial gifts, and then understand what's associated with that and who's the contact person, and make sure that that doesn't go out that way. But instead, it got thrown in together with all of the other donor names, and they just started sending stuff out. And that is, to my mind, and from a business person's mind, like, actually insane. I think that it just doesn't make any sense at all to me. When I've talked to fundraisers about it, they just say, well, we just don't have the resources, or it takes too much time, or whatever. But no one's been able to present to me a reason that I will accept about why they don't parse their lists and market accordingly, market differently for different for different lists. So that's a big deal. But the other piece of it that you mentioned about the you know, giving with integrity, and honest relationships, is a huge piece of my book and my thinking on this. Is that the idea is that the way that I explain it is that I think that fundraisers think of donors in a number of ways, none of which is good. And not all fundraisers, again, there's some fundraisers and the organizations I'm involved with, their fundraisers are wonderful, but I think they're the minority. So some of the ways that they think of us is they think of donors as aliens, really, like people who are not like them. And so when you think of, I think it's what Us or People magazine that says, hey, celebrities, they're just like you. These are, you know, the donors are human beings, and they have families, and they have lives, and they have other things that they do. And instead, they think of donors as, and so they really don't really honestly want to know about that donor. In fact, I believe, and I know this is a little cynical, but I believe that they would really rather we were a piggy bank. And if you imagine a piggy bank and you see it, it's full of money, and you just want to smash the piggy bank and get the money and get out. And I feel often like that is how nonprofits see donors, or how they'd like to even see donors, because, you know, that we were just inanimate objects and we don't talk back, and you don't have to do anything for us. You just take the money and run. And that is a really depressing thought when these organizations and these fundraisers are part of organizations with missions that are about you know, heart and social justice and doing mm-hmm. the right thing and integrity, and yet they have people asking for money that really would prefer that we just gave them the money and didn't really talk back. So I think that the key to actually opening up this huge amount of money that is sitting on the table, huge, is to really start treating people like donors. Or the really easiest thing that I've been writing about is just pretend, like, talk into a mirror and pretend you're talking to yourself and the person in the mirror is the donor, and see if you would respond to the things that you're now saying to those donors. And most of the time I'm finding, whether it be sending an email or sending snail mail or talking to somebody, the fundraisers that I've suggested that idea to, they're shocked. They really, really think that the donors are just this different, scary thing, and that they have to treat a certain way because they were told that in whatever fundraising school or from other people who mentored them. And the minute that they start thinking of donors as humans, and they start thinking of how would you feel if somebody was coming to you, because let's face it, all of us, most of us have donated something at some point. But the minute they start seeing you as a human, the rest of it seems to fall into place.
Right. And that's kind of an interesting thing to say, because I do think you're right. I do think that there's sort of a perceived power differential around what it means to be a donor. And I think that's scary. I think that's scary to folks. You know, here's a person who, as you say, is the piggy bank. And if I can no longer get stuff out of the piggy bank, then we're all in trouble. And that's a scary thing to have to contend with when you're trying
to. And it's not to say that all donors are, you know, the same, because just like all fundraisers or all humans are different, all donors are different too. So there are donors who you might not want to interact with, or you might have to interact with kid gloves and the way that they want. I knew somebody once who, a big fundraiser, and she told me that she had this client who just, she went once a year to his office. He gave her a check for $1 million and said, "I don't want to see you again for a year."
Goodness.
And that was the end of it. And they've done this game for years. And so, but that is vastly in the minority. And most people, especially younger donors, who are the key to these nonprofits continuing to be successful and the good work continuing to be done, the key to it is really not going that direction. That's fine. We understand those rules, and that's great. But those are not the rules for the vast majority of donors and prospective donors right now, where they want to really know about the organization. They want to have a real authentic relationship with the organization and the fundraiser. And they want to know, you know, details on where the money's going.
Yep. You've said something else in your blog, which I think sort of rings true. You say that older donors are dying and the younger donors, millennials, Gen Xers, and most people under 70 are walking away, or at least aren't embracing the same culture of philanthropy that their elders have. Why do you think this is the case? And how do we make philanthropy more approachable to the younger folks? Or is it simply inability, you know, are the younger generations simply not making the kind of money that makes philanthropy possible for them?
So first of all, I've been on a number of boards where people are talking about bringing someone to a board who is 20 or 30 years old, and which could be really good for the board in how those operate. But then they'll say, every single time, and they'll say, "Oh no, we can't have that person. They don't have any money." Or young people, "We can't have somebody in their 20s or 30s. They don't have any money." Well, I think I challenge all of your listeners to go look online and see how many, you know, what the age are of the, I don't know, million people who became millionaires last year. Okay, maybe it's 100,000, but a whole lot of people. I mean, look at your average Google employee or your average Facebook person who's been there, or people who had Amazon stock or whatever it is. Those people have money and nobody is talking to them. And to assume that they don't have money because they're younger is just, it doesn't make any sense. On top of it, younger people, all the research shows that younger people are actually much more interested in social justice and in giving back than previous generations even. And so that's a real disconnect, because if they're interested, but no one will talk to them because of their age and making assumptions, then we've got a really big problem here. And as the, what I call it is the 10 white guys, I believe that most institutional, certainly, but most larger nonprofits and a lot of smaller nonprofits make most of their income, most of their revenue donations are from usually a group of 10 white guys or 10 guys or some version of that. And I think of the guys in Mary Poppins, the bankers who were trying to get the money out of the little boy's hand.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my perception of these old donors, sort of old school kind of people. And what's happening is they're in their 80s or 90s now, the people who are like that. And there is, if there was a perception at some point that they are automatically, that they're going to instill in their kids the love of philanthropy, which would be awesome, but that their kids are going to give to the organizations that they give to, they are wrong. And very, most often those younger people, even if younger is in their 50s or 60s or 30s or 40s, the younger people want, again, to know more about where the money's going. They want to be strategic about it, and they do want information. They don't want to say, here's a check, I'll see you next year. They want the opposite of that. Right. So if we don't pay attention to that, then we do that at our peril.
Right. And, younger folks may not be into the things that, that nonprofits sort of do as standard operating procedure these days in terms of fundraising events. I think that the standard philanthropic, let me rephrase that, I think that the standard fundraising modes of operating don't necessarily apply. How do you think that the industry should reinvent itself to talk to younger people just for fundraising, if not leadership?
Right. So the first thing is to, again, treat them like people. Mm-hmm. and realize that I would say check your assumptions. And if the assumptions are that young people don't care because they're millennials and they only care about themselves, that's not true most of the time. Of course, they're all different, but there's a whole lot of millennials out there who are giving every single day, as we've seen by the social justice protests that have been going on. There's people now, by the way, during COVID, who are giving for the first time in their lives. A lot of young people, and I've been asked by a number of them to help them decide, like, how do they think? The biggest question is, how do we know the organization's legit? So lots and lots of people are giving for the first time. They need some guidance on that, and they are being really virtually ignored by the nonprofits. And so ways of interacting with them, I think the first thing is you need to actually talk to them as people. You want to find out what are their needs, how do they like to be communicated with. One of the very, very first questions that I suggest that people who I'm helping, that I suggest they ask any of their new donors or prospective donors is, how would you like me to communicate with you? Because some people prefer text, and some people prefer phone, and some people prefer email. Most millennials do not prefer the telephone, and some of them don't want email, whatever. But if you don't know that and you don't organize your communication based on how that person likes to communicate, then you're already kind of, behind before you even get going. And so that is a big problem. I think you have to look at every single piece of the fundraising program or the method that you use. And you'll find that if you go through it, the standard really is identifying and going through screens and then creating an ask and, deciding on timing and what is the ask and bring somebody to a lunch and you sit at a table and you have bring a friend, somebody that the person knows so that it's not as intimidating. And you bring a big pile of paper and you go through a 2-hour lunch. And at the very end, you look at each other and you say, you look at the friend, part of the organization, and you're like kind of waiting for the second, ignoring the fact that the donor's on the other side seeing exactly what you're doing. And then they say, oh, well, is now the time? And then they ask you for money. And it's very, very, very awkward. And they give you this big giant pile of paper. And and by the way, it's typically arranged through a phone call sometimes. Right. So every single piece of what I just described isn't going to work. So you can't assume, first of all, starting with a phone call is a little bit crazy. Most younger people are not going to answer the phone. And it also is insulting because it's assuming that the other person has time to sit on the phone with you. And that's an assumption that isn't accurate. It might be accurate sometimes, but it's also assuming that we don't have lives going on. And especially younger people who are working, intense, a lot of people, 12-hour days and all of that kind of thing. They don't have time to sit on the phone with somebody who's clearly asking them for money. And if the person on the other end pretends like, hey, just calling to see how you're doing, that's nice, but it sounds like it's like, okay, I'm waiting. What are you going to ask me for? And then without doing any research, because very often these fundraisers haven't done any research, they then want to tell you about their organization and they don't say, something that might be better is saying something like, gee, are you, I assume that you give to charities or what kind of social justice or what kind of things are you involved in? Do you do volunteer work? What do you enjoy doing in your spare time? Or even looking that up online, which is pretty easy to find out. And people just don't do it. And they just call and they just want money.
Yep.
So, but the pile of paper thing is so arcane, it's ridiculous. And yet organizations continue to do these folders with piles of paper and give them to somebody. Again, during COVID, it's different. You're not doing it at a table, but when we get back to non-COVID, you're sitting at a restaurant or somewhere, or and somebody gives you a big pile of paper, most 30-year-olds and many 50 and 60-year-olds will look at you like you're insane. So it's like, really, you're and you're playing this game and you didn't do your research on me. And the other assumption is that you have 2 hours to spend with somebody who's clearly just asking you for money because you have no life. And that's not fair. I think in the old days, maybe people, you know, took long lunches as a regular kind of thing, and then the lunch made sense. Maybe it was those two martini lunch days, but those have been gone for decades. So the idea that somebody is going to sit down with you, spend an hour and a half or 2 hours for basically a fake conversation just for you to ask them for money is pretty much completely ludicrous.
Yep.
And so those people that we are finding that are potential donors, we're basically shooting ourselves in the foot before we even get going by doing that.
Yeah, I think, you know, to some degree, it's almost better just to come out of the gate with the ask first and then make the justification later. And like you say, don't leave them with a gigantic pile of paper anymore. You know, if I have a warm enough introduction, if another board member is pointing me in the right direction, I'll say, hey, look, I'm from so-and-so. Your friend said I should sit and talk with you in the effort of maybe asking you to become a donor and a member of the family, you know, that kind of.
The way you just did it is absolutely perfect, and yeah. It's done so rarely, I can't tell you. So you just stayed at the beginning. It's just like a business meeting. You say at the beginning, or even a professor in a class, today we're going to discuss XYZ, and we're going to learn about this, and at the end of this, you will blank. And so just be honest about it. But I have rarely met very, very few fundraisers who will be that honest about it. Usually they just say, and I think they were trained to do this. I don't think it's their fault, but they'll just say, oh, we just want to get to know it. And that's the common piece, or we want to tell you about our organization. Go for it. Tell the whole thing. Say, want to tell you about the organization because your friend is a member and we thought it's something you might be interested in. And I'd like to have a brief conversation with you to decide to see if maybe there's something here and this might be something you want to get involved in. And I think that's great, but don't couch it. Just talk about it. And by the way, the getting involved thing is interesting because when I didn't have money, I thought getting involved meant volunteering or supporting an organization. I thought that meant that could also be volunteering or money. And I've since learned that support to most fundraisers means cash, and that those of us who didn't know that and actually think it's volunteering or something else are just wrong. And so when you find out, oh my gosh, I thought it was this conversation was about me helping them, you know, whatever, let's say I'm an attorney, I'm helping them with their legal work. And at the end of the conversation, no, you just want money from me and you actually don't want my brain or my legal work. You're totally off balance, really. And it's hard to even leave that conversation with a good feeling about the organization.
Right. We're running out of time, Lisa. Is there any other portion of this book that you wanted to highlight for our listeners before we wrap the episode?
No, I think a lot of the things that I've talked about are in the book. And I hope that everybody who has ever asked for money or will be asking for money, whether you're on a board or you're a director or fundraiser, I hope you'll get the book and look into it and find some of the information and actually use it. And hopefully together we can make some change.
Yeah. And again, I would recommend the book to anyone. Like I said, I think it's very easy to read, totally approachable, and can easily set the stage for a lot more genuine conversations and frankly, free things up for fundraisers in the near future, I would think, especially during pandemic. Even though this is not a pandemic specific book, I think it's more applicable now than it was perhaps, you know, 6 months ago. But again, thank you, Lisa. Thank you for taking the time. The title of the book again is Philanthropy Revolution. And I hope we can circle back and maybe do the deep dig on some of these other topics again. But in the meantime, you know, thanks for joining me for this episode today.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'd love to come back at a future date. So take care. Thanks.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We invite you to be a part of these conversations. If you have an idea for the program or would like to be a guest on a future episode, please drop us a line via our website, nonprofitsnapcast.org. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.